Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is July 27th, 2006. Our session today is titled First Needs First, presented by John DeGraff. Session number DEJ 2006-4. Let's listen in.
Women and the children then have to prioritize between growing coffee and corn, and coffee brings in more money if things go well. So what happens is the women move from growing corn to trying to get the coffee harvest in, and then that leads to actually hunger and starvation because they don't have enough corn, and they don't have enough labor to be able to do both. So one of the interesting things about it is that the fair trade actually helps not only keep the men in the village, it actually helps ward off starvation because they can get the export crop out and they can actually grow the corn and the beans that they need for daily life. And so it's all sort of linked together in these ways that it seems, just a simple thing to buy a pound of coffee, but you're actually answering some of the questions from both of the movies. And I think that's an interesting and powerful thing about trying to make a difference at that very local level.
And of course, Oaxaca is the center of origin of corn. I mean, corn, all the world's corn originated in the beginning in the area right around Oaxaca and spread from there. But corn and maize has become the prime crop there in Kenya too. Mm-hmm. And that, a place where the pests and things, there aren't the natural defenses to some of these pests because it came in late. And I don't know how long people have been growing corn in Kenya, but it must not be, 100 years or something?
Yeah, about 100 years now. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But what you mentioned is very interesting because when I think of the situation in Kenya, it is quite similar because over a period of, I think, 30 years, when the government had a lot of control on coffee, you could not grow anything else in your coffee plantation. And Kenya has 6% of the entire land is what is good, very good for agriculture. Just 6%. And I think 5% of it is on cash crops. Either tea, coffee, cotton, sugar cane, you know. So people are trying to survive outside of the most productive land. So if you have no, like you cannot grow anything else in the coffee. So you have most of your productive land is under coffee. And if it's not paying well, and it's such labor intensive, then people become poor and poor. In fact, my wife's friends just cut off their coffee trees. They decided this is not worth it. But they could do it and then grow their own crops. But now something has changed in the last, 5 years, when a lot of middlemen were cut off from the sale of coffee. In my own village, I remember one of my very good friend who has helped his community to have their own independent coffee cooperative. And what they do, he went and he talked with them. He said, I have a chance to make more money for you through the coffee. And what he did is he talked directly with coffee buyers at the port of Mombasa. And he said, I will sell you my coffee directly. But what I want is for you to allow me to store my coffee in your warehouse for free for a period of up to a year. And what you do is we will be watching the market. And you tell me when it is about 22 to 25 shillings per kilo, call me and I'll tell you how much to sell. And then he went to his members of the cooperative who had to sign a petition so that they could branch off into their own entity. And he tells them, I'll sell off just a quarter of the coffee so that we have money to send kids to school and, you know, to buy supplies. But are you willing to wait 2-3 months so that we can sell it at a higher fee? And they have been able, I mean, I was amazed. We never ever had, in the last 10 years, never had any crop that would sell for more than 2 shillings per kilo. It cost the farmer 8 shillings to produce that 1 kilo. So when they get 2 shillings, it's really a loss. But the last time I was there in June this year, they were getting between 22 and 23 shillings per kilo because they would wait. You know, when everybody else has sold their coffee, and then they wait, okay, he says, I'll wait. If you're willing to wait a little bit, the prices will go higher. And that's what they've been doing. So a little bit of what we saw in the farmer's market where they removed the middleman, and the farmers are actually selling directly to the coffee buyers, they are able to make the money. And now everybody's taking their coffee growing seriously. Mm-hmm. And it makes a difference. Now, imagine if the buyers were fair trade buyers.
Mm-hmm. This leads to a point, too, that Mwenda and Margaret were telling me before, and that I was told when I was in Kenya that a lot of people had given up on coffee because, and it's kind of what John talked about, there was the head of state really controlled all of that sort of thing, and Daniel Moy at that time, and so all the coffee had to really be sold through him and his people, and they took everything and kind of kept it down. But since Kenya has democratized quite a bit, and things seem to have improved in that regard.
I think it may be, and I don't know the specifics in Kenya, they have a coffee marketing board or a state.
Yes.
So what happens in lots of countries like this is that you're required to sell your crop to the government.
Yes.
And the government pays you a really bad price. And so that's a way for the government to get profits. And if that's who you're saying the middleman is, right, then we're making a confusing term between them being a middleman and using kind of a commercial intermediary, like we're just talking about, somebody who knows the coffee market, holds the coffee and sells it at a higher price. Mm-hmm. Because in fact, farmers in Kenya are not likely to be experts in the price of coffee and how it's going to move. Mm-hmm. So they really do want a middleman. I mean, they want somebody they trust who will operate in their own interest. Mm-hmm. And the government said it was going to, and then of course didn't. Instead, it basically took everything it could. Mm-hmm. So middlemen aren't bad.
Well, but a lot of them are. I mean, middlemen as a class aren't bad, but there are a lot of, in Mexico, they actually just call them coyotes because most of the indigenous peoples are uneducated, and so it's, you can have good middlemen. You can also have very bad middlemen who take advantage of the situation, and that's been as great of a problem as the government. So it's.
But I think you need to be careful when we say middlemen are bad. Said because there can be good and bad ones. There's a distinction between, and in Mexico, entry is limited to lots of things, right? So you have that, you need competition in some sense. You need to be able to have guys come to you with competitive bids on marketing your coffee.
Well, I mean, I know as an economist you like competition, but, you know, I've heard the phrase that, you know, when we talk about religion being the opiate of the masses, it seems to me that competition is the math of the economist. It's one of those things where it's not just competition. There's been a market in Mexico, and yet where the coyotes have been the worst is oftentimes where there's the highest competition. It has nothing to do with middlemen as a class or as a group. It has to do with, is there any support for making sure that there are honest middlemen? And so there could be policies which could help that, and it has very little to do with competition.
Any other just questions and things related to anything in the film, things that you saw, or questions that you have?
I don't recall what country it was, whether it was Kenya or another one, but the one that the government had the policy that if a landowner was not using his land for X number
Brazil.
Of years, Brazil, mm-hmm. Citizens could use it. Mm-hmm. Could you elaborate a little bit on how that worked and how well it is regulated?
Well, it has worked to some degree. The law, and I don't know the number of years, but the law was that after a certain number of years, because in many of these cases the landowners would go, they'd just have huge amounts of land, and they might use a portion of the land or lease a portion of the land off that would be growing cattle or doing something. And they lived in the city, and they left their farms and lived in the city and would abandon the main household and a large portion of the land, lease part of the land out to grow cattle or one thing or another. But there'd be a lot of land, actually productive land, not in use. And so the Brazilian government quite some time ago actually had passed a law which wasn't in any sense enforced, and nobody really took it seriously, but a law that said that peasants could actually occupy and grow food for subsistence on that land if the landlord didn't, if it sat fallow for a certain number of years. And so in the 1990s, this movement grew called the Landless Peasants Movement or Landless Workers Movement, in which people, many of them who had been, you know, lost their livelihoods and things, had lost work when land was abandoned by landholders and had moved to the cities in these terrible slums and favelas, actually organized themselves along with rural people, and they came back in teams and they took over land and they set up these camps. And this has involved hundreds of thousands. I mean, this was lots and lots of people. And not all these camps were all that well run. Some of them were unsuccessful. Many of them were quite successful in actually growing food. And as the film points out, they gave often places that were for, you know, it was a poor, they were poor, but it was a safe place to raise children and all of these kinds of things. So the government has stated that it supports those folks, but it's also, it's you know, playing a game because it has to balance that against the economic power of these landowners who are still there. And so the courts have taken very slowly to dealing with these things. And in many cases, they have said the government has decided to give a small payment to the landowner and said, you know, you haven't used it for so long, we estimate that the land without use was worth this much money and you're done now. And the peasants get a loan to work there. But the courts all rule very differently, and it kind of depends on who the judge is and who, you know, how the judge feels and whether the judge is sympathetic to the peasants or to the landowner and what else goes on. It's been a kind of a complicated thing, but I found the camp itself to be a very, very inspiring place where people were, you know, really kind of creating a life for themselves. I'm desperately poor, but it just didn't have that same, I mean, the feeling in the favela, you couldn't really go around without, they wouldn't even let us go around basically without having some kind of police protection because the places are that violent. Mm-hmm. And the camp, there was never any fear of anything, you know. And it just did seem, these kids were as poor kids as I've ever seen anywhere, but they were happy kids having, you know, and felt very, very safe. But it's complicated. The current government of Brazil, the Lula government, has in principle been very supportive of the peasants and of the poor. But it's also balanced. The Lula government is doing a fairly good job, also though, at trying to keep Brazil stable economically and other things. So it's a balance. They had a big corruption scandal, which almost ended the government about a year. A little over a year and a half, year ago, the Lula government was involved in a scandal in which several ministers had to resign. And the gist of it wasn't that they were taking money for personal purposes, but that they were buying the votes of smaller parties to vote for their program. And the ministers were involved in this kind of thing. Obviously a very, very bad thing, although it wasn't purely for a personal gain, it's still a very bad thing to do and a corrupt thing to do in terms of Brazilian democracy. And several people were forced out of office, and there was some thought that the government might collapse at that time. Well, since that time, things have changed considerably, and now the Lula government is back, and Lula is as popular as ever, and predictions are that he will win another landslide in the next election and probably carry on the same policies. What has continued and appears to be working very well is the anti-hunger campaign. It has been the success story for the administration, although it's worked much better in the cities than out in the rural areas. And Adriana Aranha, who is one of the most inspiring people I've ever met in my life, the woman in Belo Horizonte, is really the head now of the whole national hunger program, although officially she's the number two person. The person above her is kind of a government figurehead, and she runs the program. And it's been very effective in cities, but having a tougher time in the countryside. Long answer, sorry.
3 years ago, our church in Trinity Lutheran in Linwood, which is north of Seattle, began a project we called Living Water. And our challenge to our members was to give $3 a week to combat hunger and water project and provide water for people that didn't have it in the world. We haven't made $3 a week per person, but that's what one latte, Seattle's the coffee capital of the world, I think. One hamburger wasn't much for those of us who have so much. But we have collected about $250,000 in those 3 years.
Wow.
We have a collection one Sunday each month. We have a bell in front of the congregation, and we have little boxes that people take home and put their change in and bring it and pour it. The kids come pour it in the well. The kids have really, as well as us, those of us who are much older, we have wells in 10 to 15 different countries now, water projects. One-third of it goes to hunger and two-thirds to water projects. And if you have water, and the projects have been between $10,000 and $25,000 a piece, so if you can build wells or divert a river, which we did in Ethiopia, so that people had on the other side of the land could irrigate their crops and could grow food, if you have water, you have a lot. So we're starting to reach out to the community. I just spoke to the Rotary Club last week before I came, and encouraged them to join their neighborhood brothers and sisters. I said, hunger and water was the top to all the Lutherans, and told them what we were doing, and I really looked to hoping to get a big donation. Bill Gates gave us a donation. But it was an easy,
that's great.
Easy thing to
you can
do,
find,
but making a difference.
That's terrific. And by the way, if you do, we do have the website with which you can go to, which is just called silentkillerfilm.org. And on that, you can find a lot of projects that you can support. There are lots of all the major church organization projects and things. You can find out about those things. There are many, many ways that people can get involved. There's a lot more information about the specifics of, you know, we have full-length interviews with everybody like Adriana and all the other people in the film, the scientists in Kenya and the local people in Kenya. The full interviews are on the website that we only used a tiny portion of in the film, so you can get a lot more. But it sounds like a great thing that your church is doing. You want to comment? Margaret.
I just have a question or a comment regarding Brazil, their feeding program. And I think for the short term, it's a very good program that they're able to feed people. But I was wondering if they have a long-term plan, or they want to continue to feed the people, rather than maybe help people try and feed themselves. That would be more sustainable, actually. Because, for instance, if something happened and a new regime came into being that didn't support that, then that program would fall through. So I was wondering the other programs.
Well, what was most impressive to me about Brazil, and again, we saw the best case. We saw Belo Horizonte, which everybody in Brazil says is sort of the model for what people are trying to do, and they're trying to build those kind of things elsewhere. But what really impressed me about the Belo Horizonte model was how comprehensive it is. I mean, it does start out with these school feeding programs because you want right now to make sure that these kids don't stay malnourished. But then there's so many other kinds of things like the working with the small farmers around the city and working with the people in the camps and to build that so that there's a lot of a lot of new production around the city, working on making agriculture sustainable by actually creating support systems and things for people to grow more organic food and understand that they'll get a market. And that's tough because the organic food is much, right now, it's just much more expensive. So it's basically the wealthy people in the city are buying organic food. But as the farmers are getting more coming in, more of them can grow, are starting to grow organically, that means the supply is larger and the price starts to go down reasonably. So they're trying all kinds of things, the farmers markets, and they're of course working with scientists in terms of production. All the schools have gardens, and you know, the school kids produce a lot of their own food for their meals, they've looked at it and said, plus the whole issue of what do people eat and nutrition, you know, having people kind of understand what the food does for them and why it's important to eat vegetables and fruits, because often the diet didn't consist of those things. And as Adriana said, you'd have a lot of people who are very, very poor, can't afford much, but they're very obese because their diet just consists of, in many cases, empty calories. And so it's that comprehensive approach that I think is impressive, and it will probably change so that over time less emphasis will be on direct feeding programs and more emphasis on people having improved incomes and better being better educated and having improved incomes and being able to buy food themselves. I'm sure that's the plan. Whether it will work that way, we don't know yet. It's still a pretty new program, but what I did see was impressive. Go ahead and just chat about.
Yeah, I just wanted to share another story of the. You saw the International Center for Insect and Plant Ecology, the CIPE, is it Desmodium or what was that?
Desmodium. Yeah.
I think what is impressive about that institution is its ability to tap into local practices. I have a friend who is a scientist there, and they have been able to work very closely with farmers who are in areas where there's potential for beekeeping. And what they do is they study the traditional beekeeping methods, and then they improve on that so that farmers have a bigger yield per year or per 2 years, and become much more sustainable with the same business. But also, they've started this. Just this last time I was in Kenya, was astonished to find out that they have developed a medical compound from the stinging nettle that has been able to control diabetes. And I have a friend who is a PhD candidate in New York, New York University, who had diabetic coma in New York, and when he got out of it and went home to do his research, had to inject himself with insulin every day. And then he was told about this powder that you can put in your cup of tea in the morning. And he told me, for 6 months, his blood sugar has been normal. He's not at any need to use insulin. He just takes this plant extract. What they do is they take the leaves of the stinging nettle, which is found everywhere in the bushes in Kenya, and they sun dry it. And now they have a clinic at the ISIPE Center in Nairobi, which actually advises people on how to take it. And they have all kinds of plant extracts now that they're using. And so when I saw that they're using natural methods of controlling pests, I was excited to see that they also, you know, are going into areas that are very critical. Because I think I've mentioned in some of my own discussion that it is very hard to inject change if people are not connected to the methods of change. And if they are able to control pests by growing something that they can feed their cattle, you know, then it's a win-win situation. And I wish we had more money going into that kind of research, as the head of the institute was
saying. Yeah, we were very impressed at ICIPE, at the Embida Point Research Center, but all the different things that they're doing. I mean, so many different, they're looking at all kinds of different ways to deal with malaria, you know, natural plants and things. They've got, it's not all working yet. I mean, much of this stuff is in early stages, and it's certainly not, but they're trying to figure out a lot of things, and some of it even comes from local indigenous knowledge in the area and so forth, coupled with advanced science that is coming out of university research and so forth, to see, you know, if this stuff works in a little way, how we now can figure out with the cells and everything, does it work, and how can we make it work effectively? One thing I wanted to quickly address, because you haven't asked, but I often get asked, is that some people feel that the film gives a bit too positive a spin to biotechnology. And I've heard that from a number of people. And I tried very hard to make a film that was really fair and kind of didn't take a, you know, biotechnology is a great, great thing. Biotechnology is an evil that's going to totally destroy the world. But tried to give something of a balanced perspective, that there may be some long-term usefulness in this. Right now, we haven't seen too much that's been very, very useful or successful. But I didn't want to demonize people who are working in these areas, as I've seen so many films do, because I think they're seriously trying to look for answers to hunger. And the nice thing about that approach in trying to do a balanced approach is that the film has been very well responded to around the world. Last fall in October, the United Nations chose the film to be the film on hunger for its 60th anniversary. And so I was actually invited to the Food and Agriculture Organization in Rome to give the third annual George McGovern lecture there in Rome. They showed the film, and all of this was ironically paid for. I mean, everybody kind of knows that I'm sort of I've never been a particular friend of the Bush administration, but the U.S. State Department paid everything for me and brought me to Nairobi to speak at the United Nations, and I was wined and dined by the U.S. ambassador to FAO, and we had wonderful conversations. And it turns out that the U.S. ambassador to FAO is a former Ohio congressman named Tony Hall. He's probably one of half a dozen Democrats that were appointed to anything by President Bush. But Tony Hall was known in Congress as a real champion of hunger issues. And when he left Congress, he was invited he was appointed by President Bush to be the U.S. ambassador to FAO. So we had some terrific conversations, and they're the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations. And UN has many agencies. Some are based in New York. The World Health Organization, for instance, is based in Geneva. The International Labor Organization is based in Geneva. And the Food and Agriculture Organization of the UN is based in Rome. So that's where I went for that. And it was quite fascinating, and the film is getting a lot of use by the UN.
Yeah, John, I think the other thing that I saw in the film that was very valuable is you made a distinction between biology and genetic engineering, using host plants for introduced pests and introducing natural predators. You have to be careful with that too, because we've introduced a lot of things into the environment that weren't meant to be there. That, like I was reading the story of Lake Chelan, they've killed off the native trout population, and they've tried several things to find something that will stabilize that down there, because they've tinkered with the shoreline level and a few other things. But the fact that if you're splicing genes from animals into plants, you have to be a lot more careful with that getting out, probably, than something that has a natural life cycle and a natural presence.
Yeah, it's probably, and these things are complicated. I'm not a geneticist. I do have some concern about the safety of some of these things, and I think we have to take those things real seriously. But I also don't take a hard line that says we should never do any biotech, etc. And you know, I was it was very interesting because, as you saw, I used the Africa representative from Monsanto in the film, and that it was a very interesting dialogue. And one of the things that he admitted was that the company just had acted in a very arrogant way. And I think that's one of the worst things, is that they just assumed that they had the answer to everything and they were going to kind of run it down. And they're learning a little bit from that. But the Monsanto story is a fascinating corporate story, because Monsanto became the leaders in biotechnology because they hired a CEO named Robert Shapiro, who's actually a practicing Buddhist and sort of a very oriented toward sustainability, who said, well, everything is way too centered on chemicals, and the future is going to be something other than chemicals, and we as a company need to change, and the chemicals are bad for the environment. And he got on the idea that Monsanto should go into biotech, that this would be a sustainable, positive answer to the chemicals. And so the first kinds of things were these building resistance into plants so you didn't have to spray and so forth. Now this is very complicated, and there are dangers in all of this, but the interesting thing was that oftentimes these kinds of things where you sort of think that they come from evil intent or whatever, somebody wants to do this, that's not necessarily the case at all. I think it would be very interesting to do the whole Monsanto, somebody to do that whole story and the story of Robert Shapiro, because it's quite fascinating. The story isn't all in on that stuff.
I just want to, just as another note on that, I have been so opposed to the whole genetic engineering stuff, and the movie just really opened my eyes, because it's so easy where I am to buy all organic, and oh well, I'm paying double for it, but that's okay. You know, I don't have, my children aren't starving, and I don't have neighbors that are starving. So it was good for me to see that other perspective. Even though I come from an agricultural background, and I'm very familiar with Monsanto, but I've always been very opposed to it. So it's definitely softened me towards the need for the biotech.
Well, the other thing is to the green revolution. I've had friends who, you know, were out there, all kinds of things suggesting that the green revolution, which was this whole program in the 60s that of the high yielding grains that fed so many, that this is just would have been better for everybody if this never had happened. It was a total disaster. It was just a big kind of corporate scheme to destroy poor farmers, to create hunger. I've heard there are films that have this point of view. And I think if you spend any time with scientists, serious scientists who are working on these kinds of things, and if you meet somebody like Norman Borlaug, who was the father of the Green Revolution, you discover people whose ambition was to conquer hunger. They were not about making huge money for corporations or anything like that. And you find that people acknowledge that a lot of people's lives were saved. Does that mean the Green Revolution wasn't without problems, that it hasn't had serious negative side effects? No, it has had many bad side effects. But there is a huge kind of quick thinking out there that just says, Green Revolution, horrible. Genetic engineering, horrible. Everything's bad about it, et cetera. And, you know, was started by the devil himself, almost. And just things are just more complicated than that.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point, because in the late 50s and early 60s, the people in India were worried about famines, real famines.
Oh, yeah.
And the real problems was India going to be able to feed itself? Which then created in India all kinds of, all kinds of problems, because it had to devote resources to simply feeding itself. And of course, now that's not a problem that India has. My favorite thing on this is the agricultural revolution 10,000 years ago, the seven agriculture. And you know how you can tell that an area becomes agricultural?
Cities?
No, the kind of plants sediment, maybe you find seeds and things. When you get farming, the kinds of plants change. Now there's an enormous change in the environment, right? And we don't think of that as technology, but it was a fundamental technological revolution. And we began to select plants that grew better. Biodiversity went down in some ways, but then we selected different kinds of wheats and different kinds of products. So the introduction of corn out of the Americas in the 16th century had enormous changes. Now, today we think of those, oh, those are organic and those are natural, right? But in fact, they're a fundamental interaction of people and their technology and the environment. And those things have been going on for a long time.
John is right, and that is not to completely say that there aren't some differences between actual genetic engineering and the other thing, and some things that we don't know about, because when you insert a gene, sometimes we don't know where that's going to go. I mean, there are real serious worries, and science has to acknowledge them.
Think about the potato famine. You guys know about the potato famine? Okay, so what happens is potatoes are great because you grow more calories per acre than just about anything. I think onions might be a little bit better, but potatoes taste better. And there's no potatoes in Europe, because it's a plant that's indigenous to South America. I don't know how many hundreds of kinds of potatoes there are in South America. They don't even look like potatoes. But because they were adopted in Ireland and Germany and other places, particularly where there are lots of poor people, because it was a very efficient plant, they left themselves, they were a monoculture. They invested in one kind, and then there was a blight which shriveled up the leaves and potatoes grew underground. Lots of people were in bad shape because they essentially put all their eggs in one basket. So there are lots of downsides, and there have been all threats.
I actually did a film about the new potato blight, which is attacking potatoes all over. And you know, right now in the United States, potatoes are probably the most heavily by far sprayed crop. I mean, there's an awful lot of chemicals used to try to stay in this battle with this potato blight, which has now itself become much more able to take on varieties that it couldn't before. It's mutated. It actually originated on a volcano in Mexico. Scientists discovered in the 50s where the blight came from. But one of the interesting things there was that they were breeding potatoes that were resistant to the blight. And this is a place where corporate power exerted itself in a very negative way. This scientist at Cornell University who discovered where blight came from and was doing the breeding, his name is John Niederhauser. He's about 92 years old, 94 years old now, still lives in Tucson, Arizona. John was breeding resistant potatoes of all types, and he actually got called into Cornell at one point and told he needed to stop his research because two of the leading funders of the Cornell School of Agriculture, two corporations whose names I will not mention, had actually told the school that they would cut off all their funding to Cornell if Cornell persisted in this blight-resistant potato campaign. And at that point, they were two companies that immediately thereafter, or even slightly before, put onto sale two of the most effective and profitable chemicals against blight, which no longer work now, but worked pretty effectively at that time. So sometimes there is a little bit of evil doing, but it's not all the case.
But even inadvertently, it's my understanding that bananas are in the same situation right now. There is a blight affecting the banana crops, and bananas are almost a complete monoculture. All of the bananas we buy are the same genetic plant, because they don't replant them. They just clone them instead of planting them. And you know, if this blight completely gets out of control, we may not have, we won't have that banana. And if we're not growing a broader range of bananas, we may not have anything, with that level of calorie input, and it's easy to peel, and it makes funny little
People around the world eat a lot of bananas.
Yeah. And all of the Haas avocados came from one tree.
Yeah. Another piece of it, though, in, you know, talking about the original agriculture revolution and so forth, that was small scale and spreading over a long time, whereas the world is so integrated now that you can have something new and it's out there and everywhere very quickly before you really know what the impacts are. And we've seen that in medicines for arthritis in the last few years. Nobody set out to give people heart attacks, but it caught on so quickly that it affected a lot of people before they caught it. And the same thing is what we need to be aware of as a risk in doing other kinds of technological innovations that spread very quickly.
I think that's a good point.
You know, it's been a really interesting week because I think of how we've had Dan here doing sort of the spiritual and historical, and we've had John doing the economic and historical, and you doing more of the social justice aspect. And it'd be really interesting to see more of putting those three components together in a more systematic way with the balance, because it just seems so interesting how, you know, we have to learn from the past. We have to have our faith reflected in some of this. I think we need to make good economic decisions, but we also need to have something of a conscience. And it seems like it's so hard to balance all of these things. And I think for John and me as academics also, it's often interesting how we do specialize so much sometimes that we need that way of bringing and integrating those anthropological cultural issues and with social justice in our faith is a difficult task. You feel like you have to be an expert in so many things. Mm-hmm. but it's been a very instructive week.
Well, that's fun. And Moenda has so much to say about that. Just I enjoyed mm-hmm. your comments about, you know, again, the having to, when we, whatever we apply, all of these things, having to, it will only be effectively implied if we have an understanding of the culture in which it's.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, definitely. I wanted to mention the, I think there was something that was talked about in the movie giving the farmers access to even all this research that is going on their behalf. And I'm always reminded of a situation, I think 2 or 3 years ago, when there was a lot of maize in Ethiopia, a big bumper harvest. But, I mean, those of you who know a little bit about Ethiopia, it's very mountainous. Mm-hmm. And access by road is minimal. So you have so much in one season. And if you want to go across the ridge down towards the Kenyan border, they have nothing. And these people on the other end are forced to sell their crop for very little because they don't have enough storage, they can't keep it. And I'm comparing it to this country where most of the food is trapped. You know, somebody did a research the products, how far an apple travels, you know, from where it is coming to and in that amount of time. And one of the things that seems to be very, very easy to see is that if food was shared, you know,
right.
even within the country,
mm-hmm.
because in the case of Brazil, they said, we have enough, we're producing enough food. But it's not reaching everybody who needs it. And I think just access to those kinds of things seems to be the priority. How do you get food from point A to B when it's needed?
Infrastructure is a huge issue. I mean, even Mbita Point, where they're doing this wonderful research, it's hard to get there. You spend a lot of time on really awful roads.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
John? I think that's, as I said this morning, my proclamation, that it really is very, very difficult to and this gets back to the, this is politics, not economics. It's economics and agriculture too, but this, in this system, it's, there's no wealth constraint. There's no technological constraint. There's a political problem in investing in what has to be public resources into solving these problems. No private individual can do it, or it's very unlikely that one private individual or corporation or organization will be able to bear the costs and reap the benefits, because most of the benefits will accrue to people who don't have to pay to use the road, or don't have to pay to use the canal, or the railroad, or whatever. And so these are a really complicated organizational social problem.